morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Jennifer Swigert here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Manuel Orieta. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. I'll also be focusing my argument largely on the prosecutor misconduct and right to present a defense issues because the public trial issue has since been decided by the Washington Supreme Court and the breath test refusal issue is currently pending in that court as well. They can't do this to you. They underestimate you. By they, the prosecutor was referring to the defendant and a defense witness. The you the prosecutor was talking to was the jury. A criminal defendant always stands accused of offending against someone. But in this case, the prosecutor essentially accused Mr. Orieta and his defense witness, Mr. Santiago, of offending the jury itself. This pervasive theme was likely to arouse the jury's indignation over events at trial, distract from dispassionate consideration of the evidence, and also undermine the jury's impartiality. And the error was then compounded when Orieta was denied the right to present evidence that would have corroborated one aspect of Santiago's testimony in the face of repeated insinuations that he had been inventing it out of whole cloth. And so we would ask this court to reverse Mr. Orieta's conviction for unlawful possession of a firearm because taken either alone or together, these errors deprived him of a fair trial. Now, the state has argued and is widely repeated that the prosecution has wide latitude to argue inferences from the evidence relating to the credibility of witnesses. But that doesn't mean that anything goes. Certain aspects of argument are prohibited as unfair, including comments that are designed to appeal to the passion or prejudice of the jury, designed to provoke a decision that's based not on reason or consideration of the evidence in the law, but based on emotion. And that's one of the things that happened in this case. The arguments that they underestimate you, that they can't do this to you, that, you know, 20 minutes and this is what we were waiting for, these arguments were essentially undermining the jury's impartiality by making the trial about the sort of affront to the jury's dignity, supposedly, by bringing this this evidence so late in the game.
Didn't that also go to the issue of credibility, though? I mean, the fact that the evidence is sort of coming in at the last minute, that it wasn't disclosed to even to defense counsel, evidently, so even he could have a chance to investigate it and vet it before it's presented to the jury. I mean, why wouldn't it be a valid credibility argument?
It would have been if the prosecutor had stopped there by simply saying, you know, this evidence is less credible because it was so late in being disclosed. But he didn't stop there. The prosecutor, first of all, took a tone that strongly suggested his own personal opinion about this evidence by sarcastic remarks such as, you know, oh, let me guess, his name was Aaron. So in addition to...
The tone for us is certainly difficult to pick up on reading the transcripts, but counsel didn't object to that, so the tone couldn't have been that inflammatory.
Well, counsel eventually objected when it got really bad towards the end. I believe towards the end of the cross-examination, the prosecutor said something to the effect of, you know, you think you can just come in here after all it's been said and done and do this. And at that point, then the state did object, and then the court did sustain that objection. So, but I think that shows the tone in which all of these comments were sort of building towards that. And also we can see that then in the closing arguments as well. But the other point, besides the personal opinion, is simply just the attempt to focus this on the jury. If the prosecutor had simply argued this is less credible because it came in late, that would have been one thing. But instead, the prosecutor is arguing, you know, they can't do this to you, making it about the jury. And that undermines the jury's impartiality, that they're supposed to be sitting back, neutral, observing, weighing. It's not supposed to be about, you know, the fact that the jury had to wait 20 minutes for this. The prosecutor also essentially commented on Mr. Orieta's right to present a defense when he tried to tell Mr. Santiago, you know, you don't get to do this. Well, if there was some objection to the late disclosure of this evidence, then the proper course of action would be to object to admitting the evidence, let the trial court rule on it. But the state doesn't get to simply sit back, not object, and then then, you know, try to argue that to the jury that the prosecution has been placed at a disadvantage and that Mr. Arrieta is guilty because of that or because of an affront to the jury's dignity.
If the state had argued the defendant in his testimony was trying to hoodwink you, trying to pull the wool over your eyes, would that have been acceptable, or you think that would have been misconduct as well?
If the prosecutor had argued that in closing?
Mm-hmm.
There would be problems there as well, because the prosecutor is not permitted to express personal opinions on the evidence and on the credibility of witnesses. And if the prosecutor had argued that, you know, the evidence shows that this is not credible for these reasons, that's one thing. But for the prosecutor to just, you know, declare that defense witnesses are lying has been repeatedly found to be improper. And this whole sort of these comments were essentially pervasive. They tainted and permeated the entire trial, from the cross-examination of both Mr. Arrieta and Mr. Santiago to the closing argument. And that's why we argue that these require a reversal in this case. And I'd ask the court to look at State v. Lindsay. I filed a statement of additional authorities yesterday. And while that case is not directly on all fours with this one, when we look at Lindsay, what it sort of stands for is the idea that repeated sort of snide and sarcastic comments can amount to a level of disrespect that can prejudice and undermine a fair trial. And I believe that's what happened here. In Lindsay, the prosecutor and the defense counsel were at each other's throats essentially through the entire trial.
In terms of degree, there's a real distinction between Lindsay and this case.
Absolutely, absolutely. The similarities, however, are that the sarcastic comments in this case were also used to sort of inject personal opinion, which is what the court found happened in Lindsay. And this another important similarity is one of the reasons the court reversed in Lindsay was because the entire case rested on credibility of the witnesses as to what happened. And that's the same thing here. The entire case rests on whether we believe Mr. Arrieta, that he didn't know the gun was under the seat, whether we believe Mr. Santiago, that he saw the other passenger put it there. So, and the Lindsay court said that even without an objection, that would have been enough to reverse. This case is also similar to State v. Reed, again, in lesser degree, but in tone. That was the case where the defense expert was referred to as, you know, a bunch of city doctors who drive down here in their Mercedes-Benz, sort of creating this us-them dynamic with the defense, with a crucial defense witness, essentially, being portrayed as an outsider. And that's what essentially what happened here with the, you know, they can't do this to you. They underestimate you. And that credibility of the defense witness and the defense's case was also unfairly undermined when the court excluded and refused to let Mr. Arrieta present evidence that, in fact, Mr. Santiago was telling the truth about at least some aspect of his testimony, that Mr. Aaron Letho was the other backseat passenger. And so our argument on the violation of his right to present a defense rests on both the open door doctrine and the constitutional right to present a defense. And because of the open door doctrine, it's unfair to let the one side create a false impression and then preclude the other side from rebutting it.
There wasn't any issue about Mr. Letho and his presence in the car. So, I mean, I'm not sure why the officer's testimony was important on that issue.
Well, it wasn't until the prosecutor essentially accused Mr. Santiago of making it up and said things like, oh, this guy Aaron, right, let me guess, both of these guys were in the back seat. Accused him of, you know, bringing this up for the first time less than an hour ago, talking, forgetting the name as if he had never heard it before, even though it was in the discovery. So that's, it's the open door doctrine that we argue makes this relevant. And I reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kathleen Proctor from the Pierce County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, representing the state of Washington. I'm here today to ask this court to affirm the convictions below. The primary issue I'd like to address is the prosecutorial misconduct issue. I think, first of all, it's important to note that there are two standards depending on whether the arguments and the actions were objected to or not. And there were no objections to the conduct that is at issue, that is presented to the court today as being highly improper and reversible. That puts opposing counsel at a much higher standard. You must show that it's flagrant and ill-intentioned, and most importantly, that no curative instruction could have cured the error. And that is simply not the case here. Most of what she complains as being improper was proper argument under the circumstances of this case, which were odd and unusual. I think it's important.
What possible legitimate point is made by pointing out to the jury, the reason you had to sit and wait 20 minutes is because of them, because of the defense.
I think what he was trying to point out, if I can, what we have here, so this is a case that they were in court on Thursday. This witness was there in court on Wednesday but left. We are now on a Monday, and what you can look at is on page 93 of the transcript is the prosecutor saying, I just found out about this 20 minutes ago. So he's rested his case. Then this witness gets brought in and said, well, I'm going to be testifying. He gets 20 minutes to talk to this witness, and then he's in court. So on page 93, he's saying, I just found out about this on 20 minutes ago. On page 100, he is starting his cross-examination of them. Now, obviously, the prosecutor under that standpoint isn't going to have time to do any investigation about what this witness has said. I don't even think this prosecutor could have run a criminal records check on him.
Isn't the argument then, though, to the court? I mean, that's not an argument for the jury. That's
I think it's an argument.
Court about it. I need a continuance, or the evidence should be excluded for late production or something. But this, once it's in, it's in. And the argument about how it got there is really not for the jury to hear, it seems to me.
I think if you read through this record, they were under some time constraints and some time pressures. There was obviously a choice made that we probably were looking at a mistrial if we weren't going to finish the case today, because I think the court and both the attorneys had other places to be. It was a choice that was being made. But it is also relevant because the instructions tell the jury that you're to consider, you know, the evidence in the case. And they may be wondering, well, why haven't you done any background checks on this guy? Why aren't we hearing about, you know, what you've done about investigating his claims or about these other people? And I think it was important for the jury to understand how recently this was put forward. And I think it's important also to note that there was no aspersions thrown on defense counsel on this. So unlike Lindsay, where there was all sorts of aspersions thrown on defense counsel, that was never brought into it. This was clearly something that had been put together by the defendant and the witness. They were the ones in communication with each other. They saw and they talked to each other regularly. They admitted that they talked to each other on the phone over the weekend, that that was in violation of a court order. But the timing of this was something that those two had come up with after all the witnesses had been excused and really not giving the prosecution any time to investigate it. So there was a choice made there about, are we going to try to continue this case? It might have ended up in a mistrial or not proceed forward. But that's still relevant. Excuse me, please. That's still relevant information for a jury to hear about how.
It's hard, as I indicated to opposing counsel, it is difficult to pick up the tone and, get a sense of how these things are being said. But you do get a sense that the prosecutor was upset
and frustrated,
and not happy and angry about how this circumstance arose, and he seemed to communicate that to the jury in both his questions and his closing argument. And why would that not leave us to think that there is at least some impropriety about his conduct, because he's speaking from anger?
Well, one, I think people often get passionate in closing arguments, whether they're angry or not, but I don't think you can say that. I think that the tone of him is more angry in the cross-examination than it is in the closing argument, from what I can tell and from what the questioning is. He is trying to argue credibility in the closing argument and about why the jury shouldn't believe that. But the jury is specifically instructed, you are to disregard, you know, set aside passions and prejudice. If an objection had been made, the court could have said that again. They could have said, look, you know, this is not about passion and anger and things about this. This is about the evidence and the facts of the case. That's what the prosecutor started out his closing argument talking about, that, you know, you're here, you're not to make a judgment even about the type of person the defendant is. This is about the evidence and the elements in the case. And you're to look at the evidence that's been presented and make a decision about whether we've proved our case or not. So I think you have to look at, maybe there was some frustration that came through in those cross-examining questions, but you can't say that that carried over necessarily into closing. There were only two objections in the entire closing, one in the initial closing and one in rebuttal. They were both sustained, and on the first one, the court, you know, told the jury to disregard the argument, thereby curing it. That's what would have happened if all of these things had been objected to and the court found that they were improper, they found that the tone was not proper and thought that the prosecutor was stepping on their line. It could have been cured. And if it could have been cured, then you do not have reversible error in a closing argument. And we just can't know, especially by the time we get to closing, what the tone was, because he starts off in a very reasonable, almost magnanimous tone to the defendant about he's made mistakes, you know, you're not judging him as a person, this is about whether he committed this crime or not. That doesn't sound like angry or impassioned argument to me. It sounds like somebody that's trying to get the jury to look at the facts and the elements of the case. These factors, though, about whether there was, how late it was arrived, the whole timing of the issue, whether it was believable or not, goes to credibility issues. And that they're getting together and they're talking to each other about this case and about this thing. He's going away when it's on Thursday and waiting until he comes back, until the case in chief, the state's case in chief has been rested, before he shows up and decides that he's going to talk to anybody, including the defense counsel, about what he has to say. That is very suspicious. Suspect timing of that whole thing that the jury can consider in determining whether to give credence to that testimony or not. Again, I think when you look at the closing argument as a whole, and you apply, is there anything here that's so outrageous and so out of bounds that it could not have been cured, you must come to the conclusion that while it's not a perfect closing argument, it is not one that is reversible, and the court should reject that contention. Regarding the issue about the exclusion of the evidence, I have to agree with the court. The jury was well informed that there were four people in the car. They even knew that one of them had been identified, although the name had not been done there. I think the main difference I do is that defense counsel says, well, he was clearly challenging the witness about making up these names, or the name of the Aaron name, and I do not see that in the transcript at all. He's talking about making up the story about seeing the gun being put underneath the seat, but not about the names of who was in the back seat.
Well, the prosecutor did suggest that he made up the name Jake, though. Am I right?
Made up the name Jake. That's right, but not the other one. But not the Aaron. And both of the times, it seems to me when he reads, he can't remember the other name that was said. He says, I just can't seem to remember that name. But there's never a suggestion that that person is being made up, or it's all about the person who supposedly had the gun to put it under the back seat. When you look at that, there was no prohibition about the defendant's right to put on a defense. I also, again, think this is a, I think the court was looking at this and looking at, I almost wish she had just said, fine, put on your evidence, but you've got to have them here ready, because I don't think they were ready to go, and I think that may have played something into the trial court's decision on this. But when she heard why they wanted to recall that officer, she just thought it was so collateral that it was just not even particularly relevant. It didn't really restore him to the extent that he'd been intact. It really wasn't anything that would affect the credibility determination. There's no showing of abusive discretion there. So unless there are questions about the search issue or the public trial rights, which have been either resolved by the Supreme Court or about to be resolved, I would again ask this court to affirm the convictions below. Thank you. Excuse me.
Regarding the prejudice of the misconduct in this case, I would also refer the court to State v. Glassman, where the court cited State v. Walker, saying the cumulative effect of repetitive prejudicial prosecutorial misconduct may be so flagrant that no instruction or series of instructions can erase their combined prejudicial effect. That's, I think, what occurred here when we have the tone through cross-examination with these angry questions saying things like, oh, let me guess. These two guys were in the back seat. Okay, this is the first time I'm hearing this. I just learned about this 20 minutes ago. And then in closing argument, we have trying to draw the jury into that indignation, saying things like, they can't do this to you. They underestimate you. The effect, the picture and the atmosphere created by those comments and that tone was not something that could have been cured by an instruction. Moving on to the right to present a defense issue, the constitutional right to present a defense is triggered by even minimal relevance. And we're talking here about who was one of the passengers in the back seat during this incident. This is directly res gestae, the circumstances of the charged offense. It's not some completely tangential sort of fact. It's literally who was there at the time of this charged incident. And the state hasn't even attempted to argue that there's some compelling interest that it somehow would have impacted the fairness of the trial or rendered the verdict less reliable if the jury had been able to hear this information that the defense wanted to present in an attempt to directly respond to its insinuations that this name had been invented. There essentially in this case were plenty of valid ways for the state to argue credibility of the witnesses. But the state, in fact, profited from several invalid ways, including the violation of Arrieta's right to present a defense, expressions of personal opinion by the prosecutor, and improper argument that portrayed the defendant as having offended the jury. Alone or cumulatively, these errors deprived Mr. Arrieta of a fair trial, and we would ask the court to reverse. Thank you.